Hey everybody, welcome to Mining Stock Daily. This is Trevor Hall, your host, and today I am reporting from PDAC 2019 here in Toronto. And sitting with me is Mr. Rick Rule. Rick Rule is the CEO of Sprott US Holdings. He has structured, led, and participated in hundreds of privately placed debt and equity issuances for resource companies operating internationally. He is a sought-after investment conference speaker, so finding time for him to meet me today was not easy, but I'm glad we could do it. And his views expressed here are his personal views and not necessarily represent the views of his company, Sprott Inc., its subsidiaries, affiliates, and managed entities. Rick, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
So when I first reached out to you to do this interview, I really wanted to ask you about Benjamin Graham. Mm-hmm. Because you had overly expressed how much that book had a big influence on your career, your speculation, and your in the way you go about investing. So we are going to get to that because I want to ask you, what would Benjamin Graham do? So before we get to that, I'll let you ponder that for a little bit. But as we begin this year's PDAC conference, what are some overall thoughts on sentiment and mining resource stock speculating, which may have been different from previous years?
I think the industry's in a healthy space right now. People are skeptical, and skeptical people make better investors. So I would describe the sentiment as not too hot, not too cold, just right. The industry is still way, way, way overstaffed. You know, the industry would be healthier if 500 companies went bankrupt, but that won't happen. So we have to do with all the flotsam and jetsam that pollutes the scene. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of good things happening just underneath the surface. One would be, of course, the mergers and acquisitions trends that we see. Mm-hmm. This is only good. If you merge two companies, you have the ability to lower general and administrative expense in the industry, which is way too high. You create larger, more liquid entities, which trade at higher share prices, which lowers their cost of capital. In a capital-intensive business, lowering your cost of capital is absolutely critical. Finally, and this is really important, when you merge these entities, you, if you do it correctly, sell off assets that are no longer relevant to you given your size, and you lay off people that are redundant given your focus. And those assets can be put to better use by smaller companies. And the people who get laid off can be put to better use by other employers. I remember some years ago when Barrick took over Placer Dome. At Sprott, we were able to hire two people out of Placer Dome, Andy Jackson and Neil Adshead, who both made substantial contributions to the wealth of Sprott clients, and we wouldn't have got them except as a consequence of that merger. So the most important thing that I see over the next 12 months is this wonderful trend towards mergers and acquisitions, this thing that just shakes up the business in a very, very, very positive sense.
How is attention in the major companies, you know, the Barricks and the Newmonts and those big mergers that happen, how is that beneficial to the juniors in the space?
Makes more people and more projects available. Barrick has said that their investment goal is a 15% internal rate of return at $1,000 gold. There are, and that it needs to be a tier one asset, so 4 or 5 million ounces. If the Newmont merger were to proceed, I'm not saying that it will or it won't.
With Goldcorp?
Yeah. Well, or with Barrick. Either of the mergers.
Okay.
If you constrain what they do to properties that meet those hurdles, it probably means that 100 projects worldwide could be sold to juniors. Those projects are not germane to Barrick. They're not germane to Newmont. But they could be hugely germane to a 200 million market cap or 100 million market cap junior. That means that the project gets advanced. It means that a smaller company gets to advance. It also means that Newmont and Barrick don't distract themselves on projects that can't make a material difference to them. It's good throughout the business.
So I'm glad we're talking about the M&A stuff because something, my observation, and you know, I have a been a speculator, or investor, or in, even in this industry for very long to know numerous cycles, right? But from what I'm seeing is, I look at these announcements of these mergers, usually stock for stock type of transactions,
and they say, well, it's a 20% or a 40% premium. And I'm just curious, it's like, is that really a premium at this cycle, in the lower stage of this cycle, if we're just coming out of a bear market, should speculators and investors really consider a 20 or 40% premium a good deal for them?
Well, that depends. An investor who asks him or herself that question presumes that that investor is smart enough and works hard enough to have done a net present value calculation. For most investors, the answer has to be yes, because all they have the sophistication to watch is price. And if you get offered $20 for a $15 stock, you can lock in that premium by, in effect, arbitraging that same day. So for you, it's a real premium. If you're a more sophisticated investor who has a point of view on the price of gold and who is able to do net present value calculations, if you decide that this $15 stock is worth $30, the fact that somebody proposes to pay you $20 for it probably doesn't work. But that itself presupposes the idea that the investor himself or herself has done the work to make a value determination. In my experience, that's about 2% of investors.
So I want to kind of get into the way you kind of crunch numbers here a little bit, and now we'll transition into what would Benjamin Graham do? You have spoken numerous times about, I think you were in college and a professor gave you The Intelligent Investor and you spent a long weekend reading it. I could not finish it in a weekend. Like, it took me quite some time. But other than the fact that I'm not convinced Benjamin Graham ever would have even touched this sector, would you agree with that? And how did you transition from that book into something more with more risk?
I was, I'll answer the question in reverse order.
Okay.
There are points in time when Graham would be attracted to this business, because Graham believed in the concept of ultimate valuations. So there are situations where mining companies sell at extraordinary discounts to net present value and generate substantial free cash. What Ben Graham said, first of all, was to invest in yourself and develop an expertise so that you could do valuation analysis that other people couldn't do. And also to maintain a sense of who you were. The key tenets of Graham were margin of safety, defensible moat, which has to do with value, and Mr. Market. The supposition of Mr. Market, which was brilliant, is that you compete in a market with people who don't compete. They're manic depressives. They don't think, they only feel. So you have points in time in this market where some mining companies are selling at a discount to working capital. They're selling at a discount to cash, and they generate free cash. Graham referred to those as free bonds. The person who gave me the book, Intelligent Investor, was a wonderful man, now deceased, named Peter Kundal. And during the early part of the decade of the 70s, you'll remember the decade, well, you won't remember because you're too young, but your father would remember the decade of the 70s as a period where there was dramatic rise in commodity prices, partially because at the beginning of the decade they were so ludicrously oversold. So at the point in time when I read Graham and Dodd, there were spectacular bargains in the resource sector. There were timberland companies that were selling for less than the value of perhaps 5% of their land as developable real estate. There were ludicrous bargains. And so employing the valuation methodology to resource stocks using Graham and Dodd methodology worked very, very, very well.
Are you seeing similar bargains in other industries, like in agriculture, by chance?
Right now, the only Graham Dodd values that I'm seeing that I'm smart enough to understand, they're doubtless occurring in industries that I don't know, but the only Graham Dodd values that I'm seeing in industries I understand are in dry bulk shipping. The dry bulk shipping business, dry bulk quoted rates fell by 85%. And then after that, they fell by half. And so there's capacity in dry bulk shipping that's on the sea right now that's selling at a discount to scrap that's yielding 7.5% or 8%. Those are incredible bargains. Could they get more incredible? Yeah, absolutely. But what happened very recently, where an already ludicrously depressed market ran into Vale's problems, which has constrained Vale's iron shipments. What you did is you took a whole another knock to capacity in dry bulk shipping, yeah. And it's stupidly cheap.
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting connection. I think a lot of people would be interested in putting together. So back to Benjamin Graham, other than the ETFs that are hugely popular now that are available to help lower risk in mining and metals, what other types of plays do you think Ben Graham might consider now, which were perhaps unavailable decades ago?
Graham would have avoided the ETFs like a plague in sectors like mining, because they're polluted with companies that, although they trade, have very poor valuation characteristics. What Graham would have said is that an ETF is a collection of idiots for a collection of idiots. I'm not knocking them in broader market securities, but in a circumstance like mining, where 60% of the population base of the companies are probably valueless, an ETF ends up being a loser collection, often. They are useful for people. I mean, ironically, I think they're very useful in this market because there are people who need to be involved in gold stocks who won't take the time to educate themselves. So for a generalist investor that wants a piece of the gold market at a point in time where the gold market is definably cheap, like now, they're a very good vehicle. For people who listen to a podcast that's Mining Stocks Daily, that theoretically are going to take the time to understand the sector, they will do better with a narrowly focused approach. Sure, start with the ETF, preferably the Sprott ETF, of course, if you have a choice.
Shameless plug.
But of course, you know, ours is factors based, and we try and avoid the loser syndrome. But the truth is, over time, narrow your focus down to something like 10 stocks that you understand very, very, very well. And you will, over time, do two things. You'll educate yourself, which is useful, and you'll do better, too.
Do you think Graham would have been more interested in something like a royalty company or like an EMX that's like the royalty generator company? Do you think that would be more attractive to him?
Yes and yes. Ben Graham cared about risk-adjusted return on capital employed. Most people who speculate on mining stocks want excitement as opposed to performance. So looking at the prospect generator, just as an example, when I was in university, I was taught that 1 in 3,000 mineralized anomalies became a mine. So the headline risk-reward in mining, the Howe Street risk-reward in mining, is a 1 in 3,000 chance to make a 10-to-1 return. This is profoundly stupid arithmetic. By contrast, in the prospect generator, where you use your intellectual capital and somebody else's physical capital, over 40 years, I've invested in about 65. The reason I don't give you an exact number is because I can't remember. About 65 prospect generators. And I've now participated in 21 economic discoveries and takeovers. A young intern I had working for us said that that return was 3 standard deviations. Better than the market. Would Graham understand the durable competitive advantage of 3 standard deviations outperformance and a superior financial model? Yes. Going to the royalty and streaming, would he prefer royalty and streaming? Yes. If you look at the median operating margin in the royalty and streaming space, it's 65%. If you look at the operating margin in operating mining companies, the ones that aren't losing money, by the way, it's 14%. So the royalty and streaming companies sell at a premium to the operating companies because they're 4 times as profitable and they have no sustaining capital investments. What's important, and what Graham would understand, because he would take the time to work, that most investors won't understand, is that far from having their growth behind them, which is the knock on royalty and streaming companies, their growth is ahead of them. The mergers and acquisition circumstance that you're seeing now will cause probably $12 to $14 billion worth of divestitures to occur over the next 24 months. And the companies that acquire the assets that are being divested by the big companies and the companies that finance these smaller projects into production will increasingly use streams as a financing mechanism to do these transactions.
Right.
And so there's probably $14 billion in visible transactions before you look at the below investment grade credit demand over the next 5 years. I would submit to you that the growth of the streaming companies is not behind it, but rather ahead. So you have a business that earns higher operating margins, that has no sustaining capital risk, and has an absolute demand for deployment measured in the billions of dollars.
Right.
Would Graham have been smart enough to recognize that? Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, that's very interesting. How do you define undervalue? Because all we've heard all year is how undervalued all these juniors are. But definition change for you?
The juniors as a group are never undervalued. The juniors as a group are perpetually overvalued. If you merged every junior mining company in the world into one company, call it Junior Explorco, that company would lose, defined as cash expenditures minus sales or profits made. The junior mining industry as a whole loses $2 billion in an extremely good year. In a bad year, it loses $8 billion. So think through, how would Graham value that business? 8 times losses? 12 times losses? Maybe when the gold price is up, 15 times losses? You get my point. The industry is perpetually overvalued. What people forget with that very dim headline statistic is that about 5% of the players in a 1,500 company universe generate such extraordinary performance that they add legitimacy or occasionally even luster to a business populated by 1,200 losers. At points in time like this, when the sentiment in the industry is bad, there isn't much price differentiation between the serially successful and the lame, the halt, and the blind. So undervaluation, first of all, is a lack of relative valuation. Nobody is paying for credibility, nobody's paying for management, which is cheap. The ultimate valuation question comes from doing good old-fashioned securities analysis. What is a property worth? Now, the industry would have you say, this piece of moose pasture over here, this 800,000 ounces in the Yukon is worth $50 an ounce.
Yeah.
No, it's not. It's selling for $50 an ounce. But they say because this 800,000 ounces is selling for $50 an ounce, our 1.3 million ounces should be selling for $50 an ounce too. With no sense of what the expected future cash flow from those ounces are. Establishing valuation takes place in two different ways. A credit way, which is simply discounted net present value of future cash flows, or on an asset valuation basis. Who could you sell this to and for how much money? As a lender, Sprott lends money often to companies to build mines, so they have no visible means of repayment other than what we're lending against. Our criterion for lending is if they begin to fail, who can we sell the asset to and for how much? That's hardcore valuation analysis. You need to add into that the so-called redundant assets. It amuses me that accountants consider cash redundant. My cash has never been redundant, but we'll leave that aside. Add back redundant assets, less expenditures over the period of time that you intend to hold the asset, and then assets that are perhaps distal to the focus of the companies but could be turned into cash. The great work that Kundal did and other value investors, Marty Whitman, people like that, often focused on redundant assets. There would be, in a corporate vehicle, an asset that nobody was focused on that was worth $30 million in a $100 million wrapper. And so it's important when you do valuation, first of all, to do enterprise value, which is market cap minus cash, plus debt, against either EBIT or liquidation value. Most investors pay attention to price. They conflate price with value. The price information is only useful if it varies substantially from value, positively or negatively. Because establishing valuations is imprecise, and because it's difficult, people pay zero attention to value and all kinds of attention to price. And those people are the normal and natural prey of the Ben Grahams of the world.
That's all the questions I have for you.
Great.
I think our listeners are certainly going to maybe listen to this once or twice to go back and analyze what you said. But thank you so much for your time. And have a great couple days here in PDAC. I look forward to seeing you on the floor.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
My pleasure.